Good morning, everyone. All morning long, the numbers have stayed pretty steady. I'll repeat them now, but they are likely to rise as more health professionals weigh in later today. An outbreak of swine flu in Mexico City, first reported in Mexico City, has apparently killed 103 people in that city, although it's believed only 22 or so are actually confirmed to this specific strain of the virus. More than 1,600 people are believed to have contracted the swine flu virus in Mexico City, and around the world there are other cases. As far as New Zealand and other places around the world, 20 confirmed cases here in the United States, 5 states, California to New York, Ohio and Texas. It's an outbreak at this point in all of those places concerned. It's not an epidemic even in Mexico, and it's too early to call it a pandemic, which is, of course, the worst case scenario and the early fear of people like Lori Garrett, Pulitzer Prize winning science journalist and writer of 2 best-selling books, one of which is called The Coming Plague. She's now a senior fellow for global health issues with the Council on Foreign Relations. Lori, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
I imagine you spent all of your weekend answering questions of friends and also colleagues. Is this the big one? How did you answer them?
Well, I said it's too soon to tell. We don't know what the denominator is, which is to say, in Mexico, we don't know really how many people have been infected and not taken seriously ill and not died. So we don't know. Is it 103 deaths out of 2,000? That would be terrible. Is it 103 deaths out of 10 million? Well, it's sad for each family, but it's not terrible for a pandemic. So we still have big black boxes.
And part of the concern here, and this is something that I know you cover a lot, is the difficulty in assembling quality information at this stage of an outbreak like this. The reporting infrastructure is either not great or is just too complex a problem. Which do you think it is?
Well, it's a little of both. Actually, the Mexican public health system is pretty darn good, and they do better than the United States on a lot of public health things such as child vaccination. I know a lot of Americans are prone to think of Mexico as a second-class country, a poor country, but in fact they have an excellent public health infrastructure and better access to health care for Mexicans than we have in the United States for Americans. That said, the problem they have now is having rapid diagnostics for influenza, and specifically a very rapid way to diagnose who has this particular strain versus any other type of flu or other illnesses that cause similar symptoms. And we would have the same problem in the United States. This is not an easy thing to do. Any fever, any sort of nausea, feeling lousy, weak, fatigue, muscle aches, well, that's pretty much how a wide range of diseases and infections start, with the same set of symptoms.
And is it the case that to figure out if it's actually this strain, you have to send something, a blood test or something, to Atlanta? That's really the infrastructure in the U.S.?
That is indeed the infrastructure in the U.S., Atlanta and a handful of other labs. And in fact, Mexico sent some of their early samples all the way up to Winnipeg, Canada, to a high-security laboratory there.
So Keith Bradshaw, also joining us now, Hong Kong bureau chief for The New York Times. The infrastructure in Hong Kong, with more recent experience with avian flu and SARS, is better prepared to do the notification. Any sort of indication that the reporting job on the front lines in Hong Kong has unearthed any cases that might be relevant here?
So far, there are no confirmed cases in Hong Kong whatsoever. The city has been terrified of the possibility of some kind of a large outbreak of disease ever since SARS in 2003 and the bird flu fears, as you mentioned, in 2004 and 2005. So it's very well equipped for this sort of thing. It will have not one but 6 different local public hospitals in the city all up and running doing tests very quickly by this Thursday. They did test 2 people today, both of whom were negative, a 77-year-old woman, a grandmother who'd been to Mexico and back and was immediately tested, found negative. Her 4-year-old daughter who'd been exposed to her, also negative. And there's one possible. To give you an idea of how thorough the Hong Kong authorities are, they quarantined someone in a hospital because they had come through San Francisco, where there are no confirmed cases in that city, specifically in California yet. But they quarantined someone for having signs of any respiratory distress and for having gone through San Francisco, and that person is still being tested at the hospital.
Now, does that sense of precaution and unilateral quarantines in Hong Kong make people feel better, or is it really a case where fears on the part of the population based on these experiences you've described cause governments to do things that could have, you know, bad political implications down the line?
That's a tricky one. In Hong Kong, the government is very much inclined to err on the side of being too cautious. The predecessor for the current health minister here in Hong Kong lost his job for not being aggressive enough in responding to SARS in 2003. The government was nearly toppled by very large street demonstrations after SARS that were partly in response to SARS, also in response to some other issues. But there has been a general strong demand from the population here. Never again do people want to end up in wearing face masks in empty streets. Now, it might happen again. It's hard to avoid it in the case of flu, but there's a tendency to err on the side of caution here.
Well, Laurie Garrett, Keith Bradshaw describes that for its own survival reasons, the government is erring on the side of caution. Is that a good public health strategy as well?
Well, I think everybody should pay attention to Hong Kong because when I was there during the SARS epidemic, Hong Kong was on a steep and rapid learning curve. They've made a lot of changes in Hong Kong that, well, I do think a lot of other countries, including the United States, would do well to learn from the changes that Hong Kong has made, including building more isolation ventilation rooms for people with contagious infections. We don't have such rooms in most hospitals in most of the United States right now.
So can I ask you a couple of sort of down-home listener questions, Laurie?
Sure.
Jeremy in Detroit asks, what impact do the huge amount of antibiotics being fed to our livestock have in the crossing of these illnesses over to human beings?
Zero for viruses, but a great deal for bacterial infections. And we now have ample evidence that abuse of antibiotics as growth promoters in the livestock industry, not just in pigs, but also in chickens, aquaculture for farmed fish and so on, is indeed promoting drug-resistant bacterial infections that are indeed transmissible to humans.
What about viruses? Anything about our human-animal interactions in the food chain, et cetera, that could be a vector for virus transmission?
Well, indirectly. I mean, one of the things that's going on with all aspects of livestock production is concentrating it into larger and larger and larger production centers and dispersing different segments of the slaughter process so that, for example, when E. coli 0157 emerged, the jack-in-the-box infection, as it was called at the time, we couldn't track down exactly what cow and what ranch it came from because all hamburger is pooled into giant centers where it's all ground together. So when you eat a hamburger, you're eating bits of maybe 20, 50, 200 different cows. It makes it really hard to track things, and it also means that workers who are on these giant pig farms that are really pork factories are exposed to thousands and thousands of pigs every day. So you have to just get out of your mind the notion of the small family farmer with six oinkers running around with 25 cluckers. That's not what we're dealing with here.
All right, a quick question I want to end with, Keith. Laurie, can I eat pork? A bunch of listeners have asked that question.
Yes, well, I mean, you may have other issues with pork, but as far as flu goes, no problem.
Laurie Garrett, Pulitzer Prize-winning science journalist and writer of two best-selling books, including The Coming Plague. She's a senior fellow for global health issues for the Council on Foreign Relations. Keith Bradshaw, before we go, what changes in the food chain did they make in Asia to deal with the same kinds of concerns that Laurie is talking about there of transmission cross species?
They have made some changes here towards trying to consolidate production into fewer farms. Here the issue has been, as Laurie so put it so well, the six oinkers and 25 cluckers living in the house with the farmer in large areas of Asia, and that's still an issue. In Hong Kong, there is now extensive surveillance and monitoring of the health of the livestock populations. But Hong Kong is the exception. I remember going down to Vietnam 2004 and 2005 and seeing a couple of pilot projects to try to introduce somewhat larger farms where you had the animals fenced off from the people and so forth. But then you get miles after mile of farms on the way to and from it where you still have livestock in close proximity to people and potentially mingling viruses.
Object lessons from Asia as we focus on what's going on in Mexico City with the swine flu outbreak, also in the United States. Keith Bradshaw, Hong Kong bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. A couple of things we should let you know about. There are actual school closings in the United States in Queens because of swine flu, suspected swine flu cases. Also in Fair Oaks near Sacramento and at the Schertz-Cibolo Universal Independent School District in San Antonio, Texas. Just an indication of early steps being taken.